Folks, this is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of a changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, June the 13th, 2024. It is a Thursday, and that means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. And I got a good lineup for you, a little fill-in about yesterday and a rewind. I did say at the intro to that, but I know some people skip the rewinds. I had a guest, really great show lined up, and it was just a technical issue. He didn't do anything wrong. People asked, did he pike out? Everybody didn't pike out. We just could not get the technology to work on his end in the remote area he was in. My wife is going to have him rebook for a future show. We're going to talk about greening the West Texas desert. And as the place that he's doing this is called Dust Ups Ranch. And you can check him out on YouTube if you want to, so you're ready for that interview when it does happen. But it wasn't planned. I didn't, flake out for the day. I actually did chapter 3 of the cover crop course, got done yesterday, since I ended up with that time on my hands after knocking out a rewind. I can knock out a rewind in about 25 minutes. Anyway, what are we going to talk about today, though? Not a rewind show, brand new episode with a good lineup from the expert council today. Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini, they're going to talk about saying no to a suicidal war with Russia. I could not agree more. Andy McCann, we'll talk about the top three exercise movements and the worst three. If you could only, the question came in, it's kind of interesting. If you could only do three movements for the rest of your life, what would they be? And if you had to get rid of three movements the rest of your life, what would they be? So we'll listen to Andy talk about that. Sean Mills will talk about how to move water with a low-flow pump on battery / solar. Dr. Ken Berry will talk about dealing with Crohn's disease. Patrick Rohrman will talk about using grafting shears versus a knife for grafting. And the person asking this question seems a little bit intimidated. And I'll throw a little bit of my thoughts in on that as well. Nick Ferguson will talk about managing a silvopasture system with trees that are designed to provide fodder and fuel wood. I actually think this is a really great way to go, by the way. A lot of these people that I hear, I pick on people a lot. We're going to get all our friends together and we're going to grow all our own food. If you did want to do that, the core of your system probably should be a silvopasture system producing fodder and fuel wood with livestock moving through it. You probably can get it done that way. There's still a learning curve, but you'll feed yourself that way a hell of a lot easier than you're going to feed yourself on turnips and lettuce. I'm just telling you. So Nick will talk about that. And I'm doing a statement call. Here it comes. And it ain't good. The new unemployment claims just went up like a rocket. New jobless claims are the highest that they've been. And yet we have a report out from the government telling us how many new jobs they added. We're starting to see a spiral here. We're starting to see a thread getting pulled. We're starting to see things begin economically to fall apart. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. Before we do that, though, let me just remind you guys, if you really want to support my show and the work that I do, there's no better way to do that than to join the Members Support Brigade. If you join the MSB, you will get discounts on a whole bunch of stuff that you're already buying. Then you get your money back, and you support the show at the same time. Isn't that great? And right now, you can really make a profit on MSB. Because it's on sale for $35 a year, and that rate will lock in, including renewals, as long as you don't cancel. If, like, a card failure happens or expires or whatever, and you just get in touch with me, and I'll turn you back on, tell you how to get back in. Otherwise, you keep that rate for life. The discount code for that is TSPC. TSPC, and I really don't know why this question is coming in so much, but that means you have to use the discount code to get the discount. I'm getting emails. I went to sign up, and it says $50. Yes, it does. Put the discount code TSPC in when you order, and it will give you the price of $35. That's how discount codes work. And you're going to need to know that if you become a member, because that's how all the discounts that we have lined up for you work. You go to this place, and you go to buy some stuff. You stick a code in, you get a discount. And there's about 70 of them. So check it out today, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and click on members. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on saying no to a suicidal war with Russia. And that might be the perfect way to describe it, is suicidal.
Why is Russia right now sending warships to the Caribbean? Should we care? It reminded me very well about the October of 1962, because that was a big deal, and there definitely were missiles in Cuba, and a confrontation, and it was fortunate that Kennedy and Khrushchev worked that out, talking it out over the phone.
The more Americans that start to think about this, now that our lives are, you know, being put in danger, it's time to start thinking about this. And one question that I, you know, want to answer the best that I can is, why Russia? What is it with Russia? Why this obsession with Russia? And this obsession with Russia is not, it didn't just start. It's hundreds of years old. What is it about Russia? Well, think about what has become of our government, of this empire that we have. It's all about centralized control. Control the media, control the entertainment, the schools, the food, the medicines, what people say with censorship. It's all about centralized control. Well, what is over there in Russia that these control freaks want? And, you know, someone for a while ago, Margaret Thatcher, she used to be the Prime Minister of England. She gives us a little clue. Back then, I don't know when she said this, but it was in a speech, and I saw it online. And she says, I want to read it. She says, quote, "If you were to take a table of countries in proportion to the natural resources they have, the top one would almost certainly be Russia. She has everything, oil, gas, diamonds, platinum, gold, silver, all the industrial metals, marvelous standing timber, a wonderfully rich soil," end quote. So Margaret Thatcher was describing, what is this about Russia that we want? She didn't say we, but we can see who wants it. So, but centralized control is the worst. We just went through COVID. For some reason, everybody had to listen to Fauci. Why did, you know, this is what centralized control is. You put one guy out there, call him an expert, and everybody listens to him. And it was a total disaster. He made everything up. The 6 foot, he made it up. The masking the kids, he made it up. You know, he had nothing. We need massive decentralization, you know, and then you don't have these problems. A Fauci becomes a local problem for somebody, you know. But when you have centralized power, Fauci becomes everybody's problem. So that's what Russia has. Russia has things that, others want, these globalists, and, you know, they're going to they'll use us to go get these things, and we have to say no, and they have to know that we say no.
The story you tell is Russia's very wealthy and great, great potential, and yet they've been back and forth over the centuries on dealing with their neighbors, and It just seems like there's such a tremendous opportunity there. What are they lacking? And I think over the years, they're lacking, and we're going in the wrong direction toward that. And that is, they're lacking the principles of personal liberty. They're best better off than they were with the Soviet system, obviously. But they're lacking on that. So my suggestion is, with all that wealth, maybe we ought to send them our Constitution. Loan them our Constitution for a while. We're not using it right now, so let them use it. And if they used it like it's supposed to be, can you imagine?
Yeah, when you look at Russia, you know, Russia wants to be Russia, and that should be okay. Same thing with China wants to be China. We should be ourselves and not try to impose, you know, what they call values, you know, which are not the values that we espouse, which is the values from what you said, Dr. Paul, our Constitution. We don't even follow our own Constitution. How are we going to impose, you know, all the other stuff? But when you look at Russia, their culture is intact. They have their own traditions. Christianity is flourishing. You know, Christianity is not flourishing around the world, but in Russia it is. They are not woke. They do not have open borders. So imagine them, imagine the Russians, they're there, and they peer out over their, you know, coastlines, over their borders, and what do they see over in the West? Cultures are being destroyed, open borders, in Europe, over here. We celebrated yesterday D-Day, and people are saying, I don't even recognize this nation anymore that we fought for. You know, so the Russians look out and see this, and it's on their doorstep, and it's coming for them. So how do you think they would feel? You know, and how hard do you think they would fight? You know, when you think about World War II, they lost 20 million people fighting off the Nazis so that they wouldn't be beaten by them. We have never, ever come anything close to sacrificing that many people for anything. You know, but it shouldn't come to that. Russia should be left alone to be themselves. We should not be trying to remake anybody. We have a lot of remaking to do here. We've gone downhill so far that it's going to take generations to come back. So, you know, that's the way I see it. Hopefully, we avoid the worst-case scenarios. But the way things are going, with warships now coming in our direction, it's heading in the wrong direction.
Chris, I think the problems are a big mess, difficult to solve, except if you want to pick the freeway, the free operation, free markets, and non-interventionist foreign policy, it's very simple. You just come home, bring the troops home, take care of our people, don't gouge our taxpayers in order to spend more money overseas and buying all these weapons and building up our debt. You know, if we just change that, change the economic policies, have a sound currency, it wouldn't take a whole lot, and it would be, you know, an adjustment period, but it might be a year to adjust. But at the rate we're going, in a year, it's going to be worse, because we're not slowing up on the spending. We're not bringing the troops home. We're looking for more fights. It would be a big deal if the message was sent that we are changing things. We are going to have an honest currency. We're going to balance our budget, and we're going to bring our troops home. And I believe that liberty would flourish, and so would our economy.
So, around the beginning of the year, I guess it was, or maybe it was the fall last year, I posted this short video, and I also talked about it on the air. And it was a whole bunch of young Russian students that had some kind of celebration for, like, their final exams or something. And they were all very, very happy and very, very excited. And they were singing a song called Ya Rusky, which means I am Russian, by a guy, I can't remember his name, a pop artist from Russia. So I played it on the air, the little video segment in a live stream, and then I did some commentary on it, and of course I got accused of being a tool of Putin and falling for Russian propaganda and what have you, because certain special children can't learn lessons in life. Because they have these preconceived ideas of things, they can't be open to learning something. Because the whole reason I did that was try to drive home a point that people seem to not understand. And that is, we are not the only fucking patriotic country on the planet. I don't even think we are the most patriotic country on the planet, certainly not at this point in history. There are other countries where their citizenry deeply loves their nation, even if they don't like everything about their government. Kind of the way things were here in America 30 years ago. 30 years ago, you walk up to anybody on the street, do you like your government? No. Do you love your country? Yes. I mean, it was a 90 percentile hit. And I played that video to explain to people, let's not start a war where people have, you know, it, with a country with millions of young people who love their nation this much because they're willing to fight for it. And of course, like I said, all the special children came out, you believe Russian propaganda. That's not what life in Russia is really like. You people don't know what life in Russia is like at all. You have no idea. In many ways, life in America is better than life in Russia. In many ways, life in Russia is better than life in America. That's how it is everywhere you would possibly go, with some you know, modest exceptions. I'm pretty sure that there's no way in hell you could talk me into willingly living in North Korea. And certainly parts of China, anyway, that I would refuse to go anywhere near. But Russia? You know, Russia isn't what you think it is. And Dr. Paul and Chris are right. That this obsession is hundreds of years, honestly, old. This obsession with Russia, not just by the United States, but by Europe as well. Russia's never been the threat that it's claimed to have been. Russia hasn't invaded jack shit. I mean, really. I mean, yeah, oh, yeah, they invaded Ukraine. They invaded the Donbas region of Ukraine, which was historically Russian, and I'll give you that one. But what I mean is, compared to the United States, Russia hasn't invaded shit. Just go look from the founding of America to today. How many years did we drop bombs in other countries out of all of those years? And it's the vast majority of them. We have no room to talk about this shit with anybody. But we better understand something. There is this fantasy world that I think Americans live in that it is like the World Wrestling Federation of the 1980s, and Hulk Hogan is the strongest man in the world. He could body slam anybody, even Andre the Giant and Ivan the Russian and the Iron Sheik, and just wave your foam finger, woohoo, and you can just cheer for a war and sacrifice nothing in it. A war with a power the size of Russia will not be a costless war to you people, you morons. And our entire goal right now should be the avoidance of conflict with other nuclear nations. That should be our top goal. We do not want a war with another nation, but by the way, has more nuclear weapons than us and more nuclear weapons than the top three nuclear powers combined. We don't need that. And here's my other thing. How do we benefit from this? How does the average American benefit from a war with Russia? Let's pull that back. How does the average American benefit in any way from us pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into Ukraine as a proxy war with Russia? How do we benefit from that? If the war ended tomorrow, Russia has the Donbas, Ukraine has the rest of what they have, how would your life change? You know, in the words of that imbecile that was on TV last week I talked about, how is Ukraine fighting for America's freedom? None of this makes any sense. And with that in mind, I ran a poll this week on X, mainly because it's the easiest place to run polls. So which of these represents the biggest threat to the liberty, happiness, and property of the American people? Now, obviously, these are people that follow me, are primarily who are answering this. But it's still a pretty good cross-section of America. And there are plenty of people who follow me that don't like me and don't think like me, for sure. But here were the choices I gave you. The United States government, Russia's government, China's government, and terrorism. Here were the results. The U.S. government was by far the winner, 98%. Russia, 0.2%. We had 0.2% of the people on this poll were special kids. 0.2%. 0.7% was China's government, and 1% was terrorism. Now, I would love one of these people, the 0.2% that said Russia, to explain to me how Vladimir Putin's freaking government is a bigger threat to my liberty, my happiness, and my property than the people inside the Beltway of D.C. I would love to know that. We have our own problems. We do not need to be sticking our nose into other people's problems. And we certainly don't need to be printing money we don't even have to fund wars that do not benefit us in any way. And we've pushed this just about far enough, I think. You know, Russia, like Dr. Paul said, a Russian naval fleet in off the coast of Florida and hooking up with the Cubans to run freaking training exercises. And we'll lose our shit about it, but we do this all the time on everybody's border. This country is $34 trillion in debt. We're adding about another $1 trillion every 6 months to the debt now. And this will go on until it can't go on anymore. They ain't going to stop it. It's going to break. We're in economic calamity. I'm going to talk at the end of today's episode about how we're having jobs growth while we have unemployment growth at the same time and how that fucking works. We've got homeless problems. We've destroyed our agricultural land. We've ruined small town America. But we have time and money to fuck around in Ukraine? We don't. We don't. And this is one place I think that the public opinion is 100% out from what the government wants to do. And they don't care. They don't care. I think if you asked, you know, let's say 1,000 people randomly selected off the street, the same question my poll here, you would get more than 0.2% saying Russia. You'd find more special kids. But I bet you'd be somewhere in the neighborhood of Russia, China, and terrorism, somewhere in the 5% range. And you're still looking at 85% would correctly identify our own government as our biggest threat. And they don't care. And you know why they don't care? Because it doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter who you vote for. We're in a deep state-driven system of fascism. I know that's hard to hear. I know it's hard to believe. But the reason I tell you is so you can do something about it, which is designing your life to thrive in spite of it. Anyway, moving on, let's talk about exercise movements with Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann here in Woodstock, Georgia, coming to you from CrossFit Garage, here to answer your health and fitness questions, especially when you have a question about being 50 or older. That's my specialty. That's where I live right now. Anyway, the question I got today comes from Laura, and she's from the USA. Thank you for letting us know what country you're from. And she says, if I could pick three, so I'm assuming she means I, like Andy, not Jack, but if I could pick three movements to do for the rest of my life, what three would they be? And I only get those three. And then what three would you eliminate from the rest of your life? Okay, so this is a... Man, I could probably spend an hour. Actually, you know what? I'm probably going to do a whole nother podcast just on this question. So the short answer is going to be after 17 years of moving and doing CrossFit and other stuff, I have found that there is tremendous value in going below parallel in your squat, meaning your hip crease goes below the top of your knee correctly. Go Google that and see what you're supposed to do, or get on YouTube and look it up. There's huge value in that. There's also a huge value in lifting something heavy. So it's going to be a combination of those. Here's the other thing I know. We want to create a hedge against sickness. But in doing so, we also want to not be taken out. If we're going to live a long time because we're going to be healthier and fitter and we're eating better and all that stuff. If you look at, I think it's like once you're in your 60s or something, if you fall and break a hip, you're like 30% more likely going to die that year. So there's some things you want to do to increase our balance and coordination and things like that too, right? Okay, so the movements. Sorry, without further delay, the movements are going to be a thruster, and that is when you take a barbell or a dumbbell and you hold them at, say, your shoulders, and then you're going to go into a full squat, and then you're going to stand up and press all in one movement. So when you fully extend the stand, you're going to push your arms up in the air. I love the thruster. It accomplishes my two rules that I've come up with for the lip. Well, these are my rules right now for doing anything health and fitness. Show up. I mean, right? You got to show up. Don't do it. And then rule number two is don't do anything so stupid that'll prevent you from showing up tomorrow. So once you got rule one and two down, the next ones I'm sort of like fiddling with. I think it's going to be something like squat below parallel at least three times a week. So the thruster is going to accomplish that. Lift something heavy three times a week. This is going to accomplish that too. So you could do the thruster. You could do it for strength where I am lifting something heavy. I'm just doing one rep. And for me, that's going to be something like 155 is going to be near the end of like, I don't know if I can really do this that well. I think my max in the heyday was maybe 190. So it's not a tremendously huge weight, but for me it is. I can do this weight for quite a while is maybe like 95 pounds. And then if I really want to throw it down and cause it to become sort of a cardio workout, I could probably put 65 pounds or just do the bar or something like that, right? So you can use this movement and make it something strength. You can make it something cardio, but I'm hitting both the principles that I've come up with over this time, which is squat below parallel and lift something heavy. The next thing that I would do, and I don't do these that often, and I'm going to actually, because of this question, I'm going to start doing them again. And that is to do not a farmer's carry where you got like two buckets in one hand or two kettlebells or two dumbbells, but rather a suitcase carry. A suitcase carry is basically think of a farmer carrying two milk jugs, but now he only has one, right? So this suitcase carry done correctly, so basically maintain good posture and then hold on to something heavy and bring it out from your leg about an inch. And then you're going to have to squeeze down with all these other weird mobilizing and stabilizing muscles that you don't typically use. And what this is going to do for you is help you fix any side imbalances because you're going to do one side first and then the other side. And then it's also going to force you to have good posture. And you know something that happens as people get older is their posture just gets crappy. Or it could be a kid on their phone or whatever, right? Or if you're sitting at a desk job all the time. So this does a lot of things for you. It's going to create a lot of core control, but it's also going to fix a lot of things. As well as when we were made and the joints were put together, the hip socket is great. The hinging of your elbow is great. And your knee is great. The shoulder is really stupid. It's like two bones sort of put together and then tendons like rubber bands wrapped around. So this here will give us great shoulder stability, and I think everyone could utilize that throughout their life. All right, the last one is going to be running, because, man, it's like the natural way to get from here to there. So if we didn't have cars, boats, and planes, we would all be walking or running or something. So I would really lean on this one. If I had to mix them up into some sort of like, I could only do those three and that's it forever, then I would mix the modalities up and let creativity be the limiting factor. So you could do things like, hey, a couplet or a triplet, take all three of these, put it together. I could come up with a workout that is a thruster with then a farmer's carry with then a run. I could do that. Or I could say, hey, it's a sprint day, or it's on the farmer's carry, it's max heavy day, right? Or thruster, it's a heavy day, or it's a light day, right? So I could come up with combinations of these things, or it's just run and thruster. So I could probably create something like 30 or 40 workouts right now just using time domains. So like every minute on the minute, do this. Or using weight domains, right? Couplets, triplets. So this could be incredibly varied, right? You got long distance runs, you got shuttle sprints. So I think you could take these three to the end. Okay, so the things I would never do again are a ring muscle up, that's just dumb, a pistol, which is a one-legged squat, and the GHD, the glute hand developer, for sit-ups. I just detest those three movements. They cause more problems than they'll ever solve. You can look them up. I don't even want to give them airtime. You can look them up. If you've got health or fitness questions, I'm your guy. Just send a message to Jack. Say, here's a question for Andy. If you need something specific and you don't want to share it with the world, then send it to andy@crossfitgarage.com. You can find my podcast on any of the podcast delivery services. Look for CrossFit Garage. And you can find me on YouTube @AndyMcCann42. All right, y'all take care.
All right, good stuff from Andy McCann as always, and I'll just real quick pause here to say I need more questions for expert panel members. Andy's really good about coming up with stuff on his own, and I'd have like two or three in the bank for him. I think I have one in the bank from Doc Bones maybe, and a few for Sean Mills who you're about to hear from, and that's it. That's it. I need questions. Eric Hammond has joined the expert council. He can ask your mechanic type questions. You know, we've got two doctors you can ask questions to. Nick Ferguson definitely is available to be answering questions. He's got one in today's show. Ben Falk hadn't had any questions for quite a while. I could use some permaculture questions for Ben Falk. Remember, you can just go to the survivalpodcast.com, go to the About page, and you can see most of the expert council there. I have some additions I need to get done. I'll try to do that this week. Some things got shuffled around and that didn't happen. But I do need questions for the expert council. Remember, the best way to do that, send it to me with TSPC expert in the subject line. You email me at jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. Ask me your question in one freaking sentence. I promise you that you can do that. Drill it down to one sentence with a question mark at the end of it so we know what you're asking. If you have multiple questions, then hit return and ask a second question. That's how you would do that. And then tell me who it's for, who you want to answer it for you, and then any additional details you need. Like if it's like, you know, this is how big the property is, or this is the solar aspect, or here's the disease that I have. But start out with just a question, because that way we all know what's being asked, including the person doing the asking. Because I've been doing this almost 16 years. We're very close to that. We're, 7 days away from our 16th birthday as a podcast. And I can tell you that when people don't do that, you often email it back to them and go, can you tell me what your question is? And they look at it, they go, if I got that, I wouldn't know what it was either. So trust me, I'm a professional. This is what I do for a living. With that, let's hear about moving some water with Sean Mills.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead. And today I've got a question about a remote low flow water pump. So this is from James in the UK. James says, I need to move rainwater from a barrel in the ground regularly to fill an IBC water tote and don't know what pump or power source to use. There's no mains electricity available. I now have three allotments since when the COVID nonsense started. Two have water on tap and one does not. I need to get water somehow and don't have a structure to use for rain catchment. The previous owner has sunk into the ground two blue barrels and has an IBC next to them. I'm planning on pumping the rain catchment from these into the IBC when they fill up. It rains a lot in England for part of the year. Ideally, I'd like to have a pump with a sensor running from either an old UPS battery or a small solar panel, so it needs no time from me. The IBC is next to the barrels, so the water lift would be around 6 to 10 feet. Could you ask one of your experts as to what type of pump I should get and how to power it? I'd rather not have something too expensive as the allotment is not near my property, and occasionally tools can go missing from allotments in the UK. James. James, yeah, so there's a couple things to keep in mind here. One of those things is if you're not going to be there to manage this system, it needs to be able to run without burning the pump out, okay? And that is easier said than done, especially when you're pumping from a barrel. So the blue barrels are 55 gallons. I'm not sure what the liter conversion is, but you get what I'm saying, into an IBC, which is either 275 or 330 gallons. So essentially you're pumping from a smaller vessel into a larger vessel, and you don't want that pump to continue running when the water runs low. But the water is going to run low before the larger system is full. So you couldn't like just let the pump run and overflow it back into the barrels to prevent the pump from burning out. So the best way to do this is going to be with a float switch. And actually, I'm going to say you're going to want two float switches. You're going to want one to stop power going to the pump if the water level is below whatever you set it for the blue barrels. And then another one to stop the power going to the pump if the water is too high for the IBC tote, right? Because you don't want to waste the water by overflowing it. Unless, of course, like I said, you overflow it back into the barrel. But then you run into an issue where both of the switches stay open and the pump just runs all day, right? Or at least as long as it has power. So what I would do is I would put this system, I would put a small solar panel combined with a DC direct pump, probably a submersible one that I would put down at the bottom of the barrel. And I would combine that with two float switches. One which is normally open, okay, so that means it's normally not allowing the current flow through, and that would close when you have water in the tank, okay? And then the other one would be a normally closed, and it would open when the IBC tank is full, okay? So that's what you're looking for, one normally open, one normally closed float switch. They used to have these nice ones that would go in the bilge of a boat and it would just be on or off. But now they're like two-way switches where they turn on when there's 2 inches of water and off when there's 3/4. That is not going to work for you. Again, you've got to find one normally open and one normally closed. And you might be able to go, I don't know if they have boat stores in the UK, but if they do, that would probably be the best place to find those specific switches. And that allows you to make sure that you're not running the pump when there's no need to, when either A, there's no water in the barrel, or B, the IBC tote is full. And you could easily just wire those in series, right? So you've got your power coming from the solar panel, going to one of the float switches, going to the other float switch, and then going to the pump, and then the other side of the solar panel going to the pump. You probably want to put a linear current booster in between. Again, this is going to add life to your pump, but if you're concerned about things getting stolen from the property, then you might just go straight solar panel to the pump. Now, this is going to require you to make sure you find a solar panel that has the correct voltage and amperage characteristics for the pump. If you don't put a linear current booster in between, the pump will burn out faster, but maybe it won't burn out as fast as long as it takes for it to get stolen, right? So it might be a better option to just not have the linear current booster, because then that's, you know, losing an extra $100 if someone comes out and steals your system. So you should be able to get a system like this for, you know, probably in the range of $150 to $200 for the panel, plus $100 for the linear current booster, probably in the range of $60 for a submersible pump. and maybe $15 for each of the controls. I'm not going to provide any specific links because I don't know what you can get in the UK, and I don't know what the euro to dollar conversion rate is now, so hopefully you can handle that from a cost standpoint. But you can definitely get this system in place and kind of running itself for pretty cheap. I do want to mention, you said you don't have a structure for water catchment, but then you mentioned you were going to utilize the rainwater catchment to pump. So I don't know if those barrels are just catching water because they're open on top or if you've got a tarp or something, but that was confusing. I'm not sure exactly what you meant there. But yeah, you should be able to get this system. If you want to go to hackmyhomestead.com/SWP, Sierra Whiskey Papa, you'll actually have a little write-up of a couple different components that I have personally used and can recommend, as well as a link to buy the solar water pumping Kickstarter. So we did that project last year, tested a bunch of different pumps, and that white paper that there's a link to will tell you how to calculate all your total dynamic head, how to match up solar panels with linear current boosters, with pumps, all your friction things. You're not going to have very much friction or very much head, so that's not necessarily a problem. But it'll give you the foundational knowledge that you might need so that you can utilize locally sourced components to build this system. Well, that being said, thanks for getting the question in, James. Hope that helped you out. You guys keep getting those questions in the Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered. Thanks.
Great stuff from Sean, and he did mention a resource there that you can look up. And I have a link in today's audio notes at thesurvivalpodcast.com right under Sean's bullet point where you can get that information. Next up, let's talk with Dr. Ken Berry about Crohn's disease.
Hey, Jack and the TSP crew. This is Dr. Ken Berry, family physician, answering a question today from Calvin. Calvin has Crohn's disease. His gastroenterologist put him on Humira 3 years ago. Since then, blood platelets have been too low. This is one of the known side effects of any of the biologics. Now the gastroenterologist recommends eating less beef and to begin a Mediterranean diet. So my first advice to Calvin would be to ask his gastroenterologist what research he based this recommendation on, because I don't know of any research that proves that either one of these recommendations will actually help Crohn's disease. He began taking sulfasalazine in 1982 and now takes that 4 tablets, 500 milligrams twice daily. The gastroenterologist took him off the sulfasalazine and started him on Humira because supposedly it cares for the entire intestine. It actually inhibits the immune system in the entire body. That's what it actually does. He felt worse and insisted he be put back on the original medicine. Now he's taking both of them, and he feels like he did before starting Humira. Calvin, I 100% recommend to you that you start and continue a very strict carnivore diet. If not carnivore, then even more restrictive, a lion diet, which is just beef, sheep, goat, and venison, salt, and water. If I were you, I would do that for at least 30 days, if not longer. And then you can branch back out into carnivore. But for Crohn's disease, if you want it to be in complete remission, you're going to have to be very, very strict with your carnivore diet. I've seen this work for hundreds of people with Crohn's disease. Hope this answer helps Calvin and many more listeners who may suffer from Crohn's. This also applies to ulcerative colitis and irritable bowel disease and irritable bowel syndrome. This is Dr. Berry. Talk to you guys next time.
I'll throw a little addition here with the caveat of I am not a doctor. I do not even play one on TV. But I have spoken to several people who have dealt with Crohn's, who have done something that sounds really gross, but yeah, you won't really think it's gross while you're going through it because you won't really be exposed to anything gross. But it's known as a fecal transplant. And it's exactly what it sounds like. Many of these gastrointestinal diseases, like Crohn's, like ulcerative colitis, and certain other things, like some food allergies and stuff like that, what you're actually having happen is a person, their digestive system lacks the necessary bacteria to properly digest food. And by doing, again, a fecal matter transport into the colon, that microbial balance is restored. And it has been, of all of the things treated with it, Crohn's has probably had the most success. There's even been success for people pushing multiple sclerosis into remission, or at least drastically mitigating the effects of MS with this. Now, there's also been some complications of some doctors doing it and maybe shouldn't have been doing it. And I would say any procedure, okay, any procedure you're going to have done, you need to research the doctor a great deal before you select a doctor. You don't just randomly pick somebody out of the virtual yellow pages to do something invasive in your body. Because even though this is a pretty benign thing to do, it's not like there's nothing that can go wrong. But I'm not saying that going carnivore wouldn't help. I'm not saying that going lion diet wouldn't help. Honestly, I've never actually talked to somebody that's treated Crohn's with a carnivore diet. Ken clearly has. So he says it, I believe him. I'm just telling you this might be another option because not everybody wants to be carnivore. And I've never said anybody has to be. I've never even said you have to be keto. I just said that you'll probably be better off if you choose one of those options. Let's move on and talk about grafting with Patrick Rohrman.
Hey guys, it's Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's Expert Counsel Question of the Week. This week's question comes from Tabitha. She's wanting to know, are grafting plier tools as good as knives when it comes to grafting for people who don't have good knife skills? I've never whittled, and the precisely cutting part is what is intimidating. I've been planning on grafting a good number of trees this spring, but the thing that is giving me pause is that I'm really not great with knives, and it seems like the cuts need to match. So this is the part I am dreading more than anything else. But if I can just use pliers and join the branches together, that would be a game changer, assuming that it works. I'm not sure that it will work, though. What do you think? There's a lot of them on Amazon and random examples of this kind of tool I'm talking about. Thank you, Tabitha. Thanks for the question, Tabitha, and sorry for the slow response. So, as with anything in life, there is a skill that is required for getting things done. With grafting, it's not as complicated as you may think. And the question is, are you willing to put in the time and get the training to learn this skill? These tools that they sell for grafting will work. However, they're going to get dull over time, and they're not going to work. There's no magic bullet, right? There's no silver bullet. You're paying for the convenience of the tool, and all these tools are going to get dull and not work as effectively as just learning how to use a knife that can be sharpened and having that skill. So I would encourage you to just go out and practice grafting. You're going to have some that are going to take, and you may have some that don't. But at the end of the day, you're going to learn as you go, and you could practice with some stuff that's not as critical. A lot of times if you're going to go out and get grafts, you can get them from other people to where you're not paying for them. And so if you lose a graft, it's not a big deal. The savings you're going to have from the grafting alone is worth trying, I believe. So I would encourage you, get a good sharp knife. Get out there and practice. However, if it's stopping you from going out there and grafting trees and you feel like a tool is going to get you actually out there and grafting trees, then go ahead and buy the tool. Maybe you buy the tool and you graft some trees and then try some with a knife. Anyways, thank you for the question. I hope this is helpful. I think that what you will find is the grafts that you're going to get with a good sharp knife are going to way outperform what you're going to get from using a tool or a gadget. It is incredible how much of a difference a sharp knife really makes. And honestly, if your knife is extremely sharp, grafting doesn't require a lot of pressure. But if you're working with a dull knife, it's going to make grafting more difficult, and it's going to inhibit the effectiveness of the graft. Imagine, you know, a doctor performing surgery with dull cutting tools. You know, they make sure to have scalpels that are extremely sharp because it's going to make their job easier, less pain for the person, and faster healing. And that's what we're doing when we graft trees, is we're performing surgery. We want a good sharp tool, a nice clean cut, and speedy recovery. So thanks for the question, Tabitha. Anybody else have some questions? Shoot them over to me. I'll be more than happy to answer them. Thank you. Have a great day. This has been Patrick Rohrman with MT Knives.
So I completely agree with Patrick, but I'm literally flashing back to my show this week on 20 things that you have to unlearn that you're taught in school. When I hear the concern from the person asking this question, and one of the things that was in that list of 20 things that you have to unlearn is that failure is bad. That it's bad to fail. And this is a fairly older question, and I'm sure this lady has figured out whatever to do for grafting at this point, because it's pretty late in the year to be grafting now. Patrick's been getting his new place in order and hasn't been getting on the questions until recently. So hopefully she's found a solution. But look, nothing bad's going to happen if you make 50 grafts and only 25 of them take, first of all. Second of all, the thing about grafting is it doesn't have to be perfect for it to work. It just doesn't. Okay. I do have a grafting knife that I recommend. It is made by Victorinox, and it is very, very affordable. They sell for, you know, around $20, and they're basically a straight razor with a slightly different profile to the blade than an actual straight razor has. I did a write up on it quite a few years ago. It's a budding and grafting knife, and I said it's Swiss Army. It's Swiss Army style. It's made by Felco. It's actually like a joint project between Swiss Army and Felco. Felco makes about the best pruning shears you can get your hands on. I love this little knife, and I love it for a lot of things, not just grafting. But one of the things I really love about it for grafting and other things is it is designed like a straight razor, in that it's a single bevel. In other words, one, the back is flat and the front side of the knife has a bevel for the edge. This makes it, and it's a fairly thin blade, it makes it very easy to keep absolutely razor sharp. And because of the way it's designed, it's very easy to control. You're not likely to cut yourself if you use it properly, is what I'm saying. And I would agree with Pat. I would recommend that you get one of these and just start, you know, don't even worry about grafting things that matter until you're happy with your grafting. Don't worry about even winding things up and putting wax or, you know, using tape or anything. Just work on your cutting. Just take a random green stem, and I do want to say, if you're practicing, even though they're not grafts you're going to do anything with, you want to use green wood. Green wood is way easier to cut than dried wood. So don't be trying no dry sticks, you know. Use something that's analogous to what you'll be doing, and just sit down and cut the dadgum thing in half and then make a graft for it. Stick it together. Throw it in a compost. Do it again until you're comfortable with it. Don't be afraid to fail. Like, there is no reason for anybody to be afraid to fail, and you're afraid to fail about something that has no real negative consequence. I want you to think about that, because, again, I'm just thinking of this episode we recently did, and that's most of the things people don't do because they're afraid they'll fail. If they fail at it, nothing bad's going to happen. You're going to take a little tiny risk. Of course, that was also another one of the things that was in that episode, wasn't it? Avoid taking risks. They taught you that in school. Failure is bad and should be avoided. There is only one right answer to any question or problem, right? Like, this mindset is why somebody would even worry this much about that. Now, the other side of it. If you want to use grafting scissors, they're not that expensive. They're just not. In fact, that little knife I like so much has gone up in price. I just checked it here for you. It's $26 for that little knife. And I think it's worth every penny of it. The grafting tool that I would recommend, grafting scissor I would recommend, is made by a company called DeWin, D-E-W-I-N. It's only $33. I mean, we're talking, what, $4, $7, $8 difference there? That's not even worth worrying about on the cost. The thing is that the knife has more uses. The scissors are a unitasker. They do one thing, they specialize in, and they do it fairly well, as long as you're using material that's sized the way that it needs to be for that type of tool to work. It's for about pencil-sized material. So there's a bunch of other ways to do grafting you wouldn't be doing with this tool. But the knife, if it's in your pocket, it's always there, and it does a ton of things. I have one. I use it a lot. And I don't just graft with it. I use it a lot for like trimming greens and stuff like that. And what I'm really doing is I'm putting grandpa all over it, right? I'm making an heirloom. Eventually, I'll give it to my grandson. In fact, I probably need to pick up another one and get grandpa all over it and give it to my granddaughter, too, so that there's a little bit of grandpa left around even when I'm gone. And making a little heirloom out of something like that is kind of cool, I think. Anyway, that's just my thoughts, but I have links to both the knife and the grafting scissor tool in the notes right under Patrick's bullet point for today's notes if you want to check those out. Next up, we have Nick Ferguson talking about silvopasture.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Tom on silvopasture. And his question is for Nick Ferguson. Summary, I'd like to hear more about how to manage a fodder and fuel pollard tree system. Details, I'm in the beginning work to implement a grid, likely 16-foot spacing in all directions to allow me to drag an 8x9 shelter in and through of fodder and fuel trees out in my pastures where the sheep rotationally graze. These will be primarily trees such as honey and black locust, hybrid willow and poplar, mulberry and white pine. I'd like to be able to collect branches to dry for winter, fodder for sheep, as well as use anything I can in a wood stove, cook stove, or rocket or masonry instead of buying in firewood. When is the best time and interval to cut branches for either or both fodder and fuel? Is the typical cutting time of year and regrowth period very different for each purpose? How thick of branches do you recommend for each purpose, fodder and fuel wood? Is there any sort of optimal or happy medium that works for both purposes, or is it best to harvest some branches for one purpose and other branches for another? I was also thinking I might burn up what the sheep don't eat. Do you harvest all the branches on a given pollard tree at the same time, or only take a certain amount, 30% at a time? Any details of what you do or recommend are much appreciated. Thanks, Tom from Wisconsin. Well, that's a huge discussion. That's a lot of questions. I won't be able to get into any real concrete details for all of those things, but I'm going to try and keep this short and concise and try and kind of hit the high points. I will say this, the worst species on that list for livestock feed are going to be the locusts, simply because any of that regrowth is going to be absolutely loaded with thorns, and I mean a lot of them, you're going to have problems out of it. I wouldn't want to deal with them at all, which is why I normally try and steer my clients away from planting those trees. They're fantastic, don't get me wrong, but the amount of headache that you have to deal with all the thorns is going to be substantial. And here's the thing. The sapwood is barely higher in BTUs compared to white mulberry. So unless you're letting those get really mature and harvesting them when you have heartwood, then you're not really getting much extra bang for your buck with BTUs per acre per year. So when you compare that to white mulberry and it's sapwood to sapwood with just a little bit of hardwood, why plant something mostly for fuel that's going to be mostly sapwood on a firewood coppice rotation? Makes more sense to me to get more mulberry planted instead. That's just me. All right, when is the best time and interval to cut branches for fodder and fuel? It all depends on the species and purpose. If you're harvesting for fuel, it's optimal to cut in the winter. When there's less sap, it'll dry quicker. It's nicer to do that kind of work in cold weather. On top of those reasons, the trees handle cutting when they're dormant easier, but anything the sheep don't eat can easily be set aside for drying in fuel. It's just going to be smaller diameter stuff. Most of the fast-growing species like white mulberry and hybrid poplar and willow can be harvested monthly or even every couple weeks during the summertime because they're going to be growing really fast. I haven't played a ton with different species, so I can't say exactly what you're going to expect with species I absolutely don't want on my land, like the locusts. For fuel wood, you're mostly going to be looking for logs to come off of the stump that are just small enough you don't need to split them at all for burning in whatever capacity you're using the fuel wood. That could be small diameter stuff like 2 inches, or it could be like 6 inches. Your time period is going to depend on a ton of factors, including the species, fertility, watering, growing season, treatment during harvest time, lots of stuff. But as a rule of thumb and general guideline, you're looking at 4 to 7 years between harvests for fuel wood when you're looking for firewood rounds. Is the ideal cutting time different for each species? Yes, definitely. They're all different critters and need different treatment. They all grow at different rates, and some simply don't coppice or pollard. A lot of the evergreens don't do that well. What thickness for fodder and fuel? I harvest my fodder tree leaves when the stems are no thicker than a permanent marker, preferably about pencil diameter or whatever thickness it gets to at harvest time, because I'm harvesting frequently. Fuel is generally harvested when the logs are between 4 inches and 6 inch diameter, so they don't need to be split. But depending on your usage, you might want to harvest at tool handle thickness or 2 inch diameter. All depends on what you actually need from the wood. How much do you harvest at a time? Well, When I'm harvesting fodder fresh or for fermenting, I harvest frequently to get a lot of succulent regrowth that is all edible, so there's no waste. If I'm shooting for drying, I'll let the stems get 3 or 4 foot tall, so I have a good length to cut and hang. Basically, you're going to treat it like a lawn. You're going to let the row of trees grow to about 4 foot tall-ish if you're coppicing, which is what I recommend. Take the first cut at slightly uncomfortably low height, generally around 2 foot off the ground. This leaves a lot of growth below the cut to produce sugars and regrow. Just like a lawn, you don't want to scalp it in the summertime. It regrows, and then you can harvest again when it gets another foot or two taller. If you cut it at the same height from the ground every time, exactly like you're mowing a lawn, it'll regrow well, and you're going to have a long life out of those trees. Except with these trees, you want to leave that healed first cut portion so it can regrow from that knobby end faster every time you harvest. That's why I say you cut it just slightly uncomfortably low, and then you cut it just slightly above that for all of the consecutive cuts. If you're pollarding, I'd just be reaching up and taking small portions every week and just drop them in the pen for the sheep, let them strip the leaves off, and then you move on to the next trees. Never harvest a ton when you're pollarding like that in the summertime, just a little bit at a time. Always leave some growth at the end of summer to replenish the tree's root system for the next spring's growing season, whether you're pollarding or coppicing. I hope that sheds some light on the system and gets you moving in the right direction. Best of luck. Keep the good questions coming. And for those of you listening who are interested in getting some fodder systems implemented on your properties, I teach my clients where to do this stuff, how to do it, how to lay it out, and I'm collecting requests for this summer's consulting tours now. So let me know if you want to get on that list. I'm planning a trip all the way to the East Coast, to North Carolina through Tennessee, then south through Georgia and Alabama, Mississippi, and again through Texas, possibly all the way to Utah and back through Colorado. And there's a chance that we might be headed up to North Dakota as a family this summer to visit family. So if you're in the middle states between Louisiana and North Dakota, let me know and I can probably fit a couple consults in on our way up and back. Just send me an email to Nick, that's N-I-C-K, at homegrownliberty.com with consulting in the subject line to get your spot reserved. I'm Nick Ferguson with Homegrown Liberty. Do good things.
You know, I have been picking on the
"we're going to get our friends together and buy a bunch of land and grow all our own food" people quite a bit.
And as I was listening to Nick talk about that, and I'll tell you that honestly, I was on somebody else's show, and after the show was over, the host asked me about that very thing, and it's what has me thinking this way, because – I was sitting there listening to him explain his rationale behind what they would be doing, why and how, and thinking to myself, you guys are just going to make a complete catastrophe out of anything you actually try to do, if you actually try to do it. And he asked me about coming on the show and talking about it, and I just haven't reconnected with him. But I immediately thought, well, if I do, I'm going to tell you, you're not going to be putting in what he called a permaforest. That's not a thing. A permaculture food forest. You probably won't be doing that either, at least the way you saw the video of some guy in Florida do it or something like that. And that if you actually wanted a community that was resilient, there's really two things I can say that you'd want on a piece of land. That would be your two most important things. One would be a silvopasture-based system with grazing animals moving in and out rows of trees. And you could also do things like pastured poultry on a system like that. And that is actually relatively easy to lay out. And the other thing I would want in that system is as much surface water as I could create. And, you know, some fish feeders to supplement feed to my fish. And I would be growing the hell out of things like catfish. And with that approach, you probably can make a community work because you don't have the intensive labor required for gardening for that many people. I'm not saying not to garden. I'm not saying not to make it a part of it. I'm saying the core of it would be silvopasture and aquaculture. And, you know, every acre of water you put in can grow more fish than a sizable number of people can eat a year. And it's another acre that we do not have to graze or mow. Right? So, I mean, I am of the opinion that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% and up to as high as 50% of the surface area of a piece of property can go to surface water if you have the ability to do it where you're at. I would do it here if I could. But what I was thinking about is doing a show about this. And then as I was listening to that, I think maybe I'll reach out to Nick and talk to him about possibly coming on the air, kind of an impromptu show with me and him talking about this. How would we set up that kind of a community in a way that actually has the highest probability of success? Because it is a very much a paint-by-numbers type of system to do this right. And there is a significant investment in, you know, some portable infrastructure to create laneways and stuff, especially until the trees get large enough to that, you know, certain trees can be used as basically fence posts and stuff like that. But it's very doable. And it's probably far more doable from a standpoint of calories out versus calories of energy in to make a community actually food resilient. Just my thoughts. All right, let's talk about what's going on and what I think it's kind of signaling that's coming economically to the United States and to the West as a whole. There's a report out today on jobless claims, and the left-wing media, even though this is from AP, is not picking it up and really running with this because it is not the kind of things that you want to hear. And that is that the jobless claims, new filing on unemployment, like I lost my job, I need unemployment, please, is now the highest that it's been in the last 10 months. So it's, you know, the last time it was this high was August of last year. That is not a good thing going into an election cycle if you're the party in power. But at the same time, we had a jobs report come out for May. This said there was more jobs produced than expected. Now, there's some interesting things in this jobs report. And I actually linked in the show notes, not to some article about it, to the actual report at the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, where it looks like somebody typed it on an old-school typewriter and then freaking took a picture of it and posted it, even though that's not what it is. It just has that vibe to it, very non-decorated government stuff. But the big thing is, if you read the last paragraph, there's all types of adjusting the numbers down. And we reported this, but you know it was change in April was revised down by 10,000 from 170 to 165 with these revisions. Employment in March, April's continued combined is 15,000 lower than previously reported. You see what I'm saying? And this is what's been going on for the entire Biden administration. Jobs reports come out, everybody picks them up and runs with them and posts the headlines. Susie and Karen and Tammy and Tommy read the headline. Oh, look at it's doing better than we expected. And then a couple weeks later, the Bureau of Labor Statistics comes out and decreases the numbers. Well, nobody reports that. Then they do it again next month. So what you have is all the good news as far as new jobs added is, first of all, every number you've actually heard, if it's been on the news or printed anywhere in any kind of a news article, is higher than the actual number is. The next is when you look at where the job growth is, this last month, the highest job growth was in government employment. There's over 40,000 new government jobs. I wonder how many of them are IRS agents. Remember that little debacle? They're starting to hire those people now. Yay us. Right? You know, what harm could 80,000 new employees at the IRS do? A lot. That's 80,000 damage points for you dice-playing, role-playing game people, right? That's a lot of damage points. So we have growth in the government sector. We have growth in the healthcare sector. Why do we have growth in the healthcare sector? That's the second highest new jobs created in last month. Because we're so damn sick as a society. That's why. That's why. And how many of those jobs are paid for with government money? Through either subsidies or public hospitals and all this other shit. So right there, you got about half of the supposed new jobs are mainly tied to public dollars, i.e. government money, i.e. stolen money, i.e. recycled, regurgitated government money. And then the rest are things like the hospitality sector and stuff like that. But when you read more into it, you find something else out. They say that the number of jobs grew by 270,000-odd. But even with the huge growth in the government and healthcare sector, which are primarily full-time jobs, the total number of full-time jobs in the country went down. It went down. Most of the growth is part-time jobs. And there's an entire huge segment of people who are working one or two full-time or part-time jobs that want full-time work but can't find it. And I mean, right now we are at a point where there's about one job for every one unemployed person. That's a good ratio, but why unemployment went up 0.1 nationwide from 3.9 to 4%. But if you keep going, the labor participation rate, which is among healthy adults who could be in the labor market, what percentage of them are? 62%. Only 62% of people that are would be considered legitimate candidates to have a job have one. That means that 48%, it's actually 47.5 because it's 62.5, don't. Almost half the damn country that could be working isn't. I'm sorry, did I say 40? It would be 37.5%. Almost 40%. Almost 40% of the country's eligible workers don't work. Many of them have income because they're on some sort of welfare. Now, that doesn't count people that have exited the labor force in retirement. Okay? So, that doesn't count the 66-year-old man that lives on your street that's on Social Security. Even though he could work and he's not. He's not counted in that. This is non-retirement. Above 18, between 18 and not retired. 40% of Americans who could work don't. Now, and this is where we have higher labor participation by females than we've ever had, so it's not like it's a bunch of stay-at-home moms. And people at the same time are having less kids than we've ever had. We are below replacement and our population's in decline. The colleges are shitting their pants. The enrollment cliff starts this fall. The enrollment cliff they've known is coming for 15 years because they can do math. And you just look at how many kids were born, you know, 20 years ago versus how many kids were born 10 years before that. And the number of new potential kids to go to college is down. We have school districts closing schools and laying off teachers across the country. Right here in Plano, Texas. Very affluent, high-end city, rich people, okay? These are the people that when I would work up that way, if it went down below 50 degrees, like 49 degrees, I'd walk into Starbucks and there's women sitting in there wearing freaking $3,000-$4,000 worth of clothes that look like they're getting ready to go to Aspen, Colorado. One of the towns just north of there is called Frisco. That's where my office actually was. I call them the Frisco Aspenites. Like every year, there they are with their hands rolled up around it and blowing on their cup and shit like they're freezing to death. It's 49 degrees out, and their trophy wives are out shopping for all this expensive clothing, and they put it on because they only get to wear it about 10 days out of the year down here. Right? That is about as affluent as you get, and they're closing six schools. We are in the middle of economic and social collapse as a empire and as a country. Anybody that tells you we aren't is one of two things: not paying attention or a liar. I'm sorry. It's not about, well, that's your opinion, Jack, or whatever. No, this is undeniable. Again, all you have to do is look through history and say, what does the social and economic collapse of an empire look like? What are the primary characteristics of what one looks like when it's heading into collapse? When it's at the beginning of collapse and it doesn't know it yet? And we tick every box. We don't tick like 9 out of 10 boxes. We tick every box. We're provoking war with another superpower. We're actually provoking war with two superpowers. We're $34 trillion in debt. We are now spending more on the interest on our debt than we are on our Department of Defense, and we spend more on defense than the next 10 nations put together while we're trying to provoke a conflict. What else do you need to take this seriously at this point? And what's going to happen is you're going to have a continuing erosion of full-time work. And there's multiple things at play in this. It's not just Brandon sucks, right? If it was just that Brandon sucks, the good news there would be, well, we get rid of Brandon, it's all going to be okay, right? The great Trumpkin will rise again in November and fix it all. No. And we are in a place where even recovery will aggravate and make collapse worse. The higher you go, the further you fall. So if we get some sort of respite from this and the band starts playing again one more time, which I am questioning the ability for that to happen, but let's say that it does. All it's doing is setting us up for more inflation and more pain and more failure. The inflation we had is not going to go away. It hasn't gone away. When they say it's 3%, first of all, they're lying. They're lying. The real inflation rate is way worse than 3%, folks. It really is. But even if it were 3%, you can't ignore what happened for the last 4 years. It didn't go. It doesn't mean the prices went down when they say inflation. The inflation rate dropped. It means they're going up less fast. But all the increase that already happens, we're stuck with it. We're stuck with it, and it ain't going away anytime soon. And this is why I'm such a big proponent of things like Bitcoin. The reason I'll bet on Bitcoin, there's many reasons, but one is the U.S. monetary policy is such that the dollar's value can only go in one direction, and a limited commodity can only go in one direction against it. Okay? It's that simple. By the way, I'd go buy some freaking Bitcoin today if you ain't been paying attention. We're having an actual dip. There's a whole bunch of naked shorts out in the market playing Bitcoin short, temporarily driving the price down. I would capitalize on it if I were you. But there's got to be more than that. We have got to start putting together more community. We've got to start producing more of our own food. And you see all that growth of the jobs in the healthcare sector? We got to start taking responsibility for our health. You're not going to be able to afford healthcare, regardless of what kind of insurance you have over the next 5 years. If you are unhealthy, you're not going to be able to afford it. The solution now to being a fat ass is $20,000 a year in GLP-1 medications, and I know several people have completely fucked up their digestive process with them. Basically paralyzed their stomach. One person, it's completely fucked up their pancreas using this shit. Right? That's okay. We'll just add Jardiance to the GLP-1, the Ozempic or the Ozempic knockoff, and we'll add some metformin to that, and then we'll give you three other medications to counteract your side effects, and you'll be just fine. You've got to be out of your mind. And if you don't, like, now he's on healthcare, he was talking about jobs, I mean, you don't think this is all related. You're just not paying attention. And this is, I want to finish with today, the common thing empires do in this stage of their devolution. They focus on keeping power. And when they do that, all of the problems that government is supposed to solve, and they never do, but at least they mitigate them some. Like, government never fulfills its promise, but it partially does. But when you enter this phase, it fails to do anything to solve problems. Because it thrives on problems. It's how it justifies it. Without us, this would be even worse. And then it becomes very totalitarian. And it sees every single thing that looks like a question as to its authority and power as a massive threat that must be attacked. And it tries to distract the people it is failing, and it puts all of its effort and all of its money and all of its resources at the periphery of the empire, while the core of the empire, the host, the home nation, is in utter catastrophic collapse economically and socially. And it's always both. It's always both. It's always economic woe and debauchery at the same time. Go look at Rome when it collapsed. Go look at the last great Chinese dynasty when it collapsed. Go look at the Grecian Empire when it collapsed. It's always a mix. It's always a mix of debauchery and economic stupidity. And then you throw a little warfare in there, and you start thinking, hey, if the generals march out and bring shit back, everybody will be happy. The thing is, we don't even bring anything back anymore. No, we invade countries, take them over, and then send America's resources into them. We are a little bit different than past empires. We're even dumber. So please be prepared to deal with what's coming, because it is a complete unwinding economically and socially of everything you've known America to be up till today. With that, I want to go ahead and wrap up. Thank you for tuning in today. I do want to let you guys know, if you want to support the show, you can always start your shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. If you go there, whenever you shop online, no matter what you buy, you'll help us out. And you can find all of the things that I recommend. Today's item of the day is the same as it was yesterday. It's the Vivor DZ260 Chamber Vacuum Sealer. I really recommend you pick one of these up. These things are about $340. Plus, you can knock another 5% off with my discount code that I have for you guys. And it's not just MSB. Everybody gets that discount with Vivor. That's the direct deal that I have with them. And I spent about $1,200 on my chamber vacuum machine. This one, again, $340. It is every bit as good as the very expensive VacMaster I bought. I even say in the review video that I did with it, I kind of feel dumb now. It is a fantastic machine. I'd actually say it operates a little bit more quietly than the VacMaster. And I'm telling you, if you vacuum seal stuff and you move from something like a food saver to a chamber vacuum machine, you will never want to go back ever again. The fact that you can vacuum seal things that are wet without ruining the seal is a game changer. And I should do a show on all the stuff you can do with a chamber vac machine. I really should, like compressed fruit and other cool things you can do with it, speeding up marinades, etc. There's so many things you can do. So many things you can do. And over time, the damn machines save you enough money in bags that they pay for themselves. Because unlike your food saver, your seals generally do not fail. So you don't have to send in a second bag because the first bag failed because it got one drop of water in it or something. And then because you're using a chamber vac, and I can't get into exactly how and why, the bags don't need the little channels. So they are very simple bags, so the bags cost half as much. You use less of them, they work better, and they cost half as much. You see where I'm going. Check this thing out if you haven't. A ton of people bought these when they first dropped them. They've got them on sale again, not quite as deeply discounted as they were when they were $329, but $340, still a hell of a deal. So if you missed out on this the first time, check it out now. With that, guys, have a great weekend. Tomorrow will be a Friday flashback, and then Monday we'll be back and we'll do it all over again. And I will reach out to Nick Ferguson and see if he's interested in coming on, and we can talk shop on how we would actually set up a community for people that was designed to feed them without everybody staring around like the chop in Washington looking at dying plants and wondering what's going on. Take care, guys. We'll catch you with another one again starting Monday next week.
Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you